Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Johanna Rothman. She is a consultant, author, and speaker, and her area of expertise is in managing product development. Welcome, Johanna.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
I am so happy to have you, and I am super excited to get going with all of the questions that I have for you. So how about we get going and kick it off?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. So let's start at the beginning, give people a little bit of context about who you are and what you do, and also what led you down the path of managing high technology product development.
So I started off as a software developer many years ago, and I moved into project management and program management and then management, and I realized that while I didn't have all the answers, right, there's no recipe for anybody's product development, there are common things that tend to work, and a bunch of my companies were not using them, and a bunch of my clients when I started as a consultant were not using them. So I thought, these are people who need to be able to release. They got to get the product out the door. So how can I can help them get it out the door? And I never worked by beating up people, because that just never works. But instead, how do you create an environment in which people can do their best work?
Got it. So it was from your own experience of trying to get those products out the door that you sort of came up with some processes and some formulas for getting that done better.
Yes.
Awesome. And so how about the transition? So in your case, you started out as a software developer and then moved to, PM and being a manager, but then I'm assuming at some point you made this transition from working for somebody else to working on your own, to basically running your own ship, so to speak. So what led to that transition?
So I ran into the glass ceiling quite early. I had been a middle manager, and I was looking for a senior management position. And we've seen each other on Skype or Zoom or something, mm-hmm. but we have not seen each other in person. I'm quite short. I'm only 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the senior management teams were all tall men. Mm-hmm. So I was challenging them in ways that they could not manage, not back at the time that I was looking for a new job. Mm-hmm. So I said, these are people who can hire me if I'm not going to stick around, if I'm not going to be part of the senior management team. Because they just could not get their heads around me being a VP of engineering or CTO or CIO. They just could not do that. So my male peers were getting jobs doing that. And I said, I don't actually have to be inside a company. Mm-hmm. I can be a consultant and really make my own kind of a life and my own kind of work. And then if I go too fast, I'll just leave that particular client and go on to a different client. It really works well, and I don't have to worry about it. So that's what I did.
Got it. That's such a great story. And I love how you basically just took your career by the horns and said, if I'm not going to make it work this other way, I will find a way to make it work myself.
Yes, and it turns out that I've worked with many senior management teams over the years, and most of them, they can accept me as a consultant. That's not the issue, but accepting me as a permanent part of their team, mm-hmm. Now there are a bunch of senior management teams who can do that, but 23 years ago that was a different problem. Mm-hmm. So it was easier to make a career that I could enjoy and live with and not bump my head against the wall, right? Because it doesn't change the wall and it gives you a headache.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever end up serving as a consultant for your former employer? I know that that happens sometimes.
Not the most recent, not the last direct employer, but for several of the others, yes.
Okay.
And that worked out really well because they were all very happy to see me, and I was happy to go, and I was happy to leave.
Cool. That's great. And because you brought it up, I want to dive a little bit deeper into this. You mentioned 23 years ago, sort of alluding to the advancement of women in tech, or as some may argue, the lack of advancement of women in tech. But from your perspective, I think that you could probably have a very unique perspective here, given that you were there 23 years ago and you're here now from a slightly, and you're looking at it from a slightly different vantage point. How have you seen the role of women in tech change over the years?
So I actually started working 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right? 40 years ago, this past summer is what my first professional job out of school as a software developer. We had more women on that program than I have seen since. So the number of women, the percentage of women, has gone down. Now, there have been a bunch of really interesting changes. Back in the 70s, we didn't have testers. We tested our own stuff. Now, we also did code reviews and design reviews with our peers, but we did not have specialized people called testers.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get testers until the mid-80s. And as a result, a number of women transitioned into testing jobs, and that made the testing jobs decrease in salary.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was a developer and a tester and a project manager and a development manager and a test manager, I mean, I've had almost all of the first level line management and technical lead roles.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a tester, I was the equivalent of a developer. I got paid like a developer. And when I was a test manager, I paid my people as if they were developers. Now, I think that is still an issue today. Oh, and the reason I could pay my people like they were developers
mm-hmm.
is because they were.
Mm-hmm.
So they wrote code. They did not test manually. They also tested manually, but they mostly wrote code.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big chasm in the testing community about whether or not you need automated tests or not automated tests. And my experience is you do need both,
mm-hmm.
but you need enough automated tests so that your manual tests actually find something different and new, and you can find stuff in a reasonable period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 80s and even into the 90s, there was a big decrease in the number of women. And this is my suspicion, not borne out by any data, is that because in the 80s, people started to get PCs. And I don't know if you remember the TRS-80,
mm-hmm.
but people could actually buy all the components for personal computer at home and put it together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who did that? It was mostly men.
Yep.
Or I should say boys.
Mm-hmm.
So boys came into the software curriculum in school with tons of years of experience programming. Well, what happens if you have a guy and a woman in the same class sitting next to each other and the guy has experience?
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of us in software are pretty arrogant, and I include myself in that. I was convinced when I graduated from college that there was no problem I could not solve.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, how arrogant is that? So we have arrogant men and women who are unsure. This is not a recipe for women continuing on. Now, I have never really cared about what people think of me. So I was quite happy in my computer science classes, and none of the guys had any more experience than I did.
Mm-hmm.
So we really had a problem in the 80s and 90s. And I think that in the O's and now in the What do we call the teens? I don't
I
know.
have no idea.
I have no idea either. But I think that things are a little bit different because with the advent of online gaming for women and girls,
Yep.
and for girls who code and code camp and all that stuff, I think that girls are now realizing that they have a right to compete and they should compete for those spots in those classes. So, if I had been born a little bit later, I still think I would have done what I'm doing now, but I think I would have, I was still pretty oblivious, right? But if I had been less oblivious, if I had been more of a people person, I might not have enjoyed my first few classes as much as I did. But I mean, I never did understand that the way other women and girls really cared about what people thought. I just don't get it.
That's interesting. And the way that you tell the story, and I never quite looked at it from this perspective, is that there was a time before the 80s and 90s when it may have actually even have been better for women in tech than it was after the 80s and 90s. And then, as you described it, the TRS-80 and all of the PCs came along, and then the Macs came along after that. And it was mostly, yeah, absolutely, the boys and the men who were sort of controlling that space. As a slight, just a quick personal anecdote, when my family got a computer in the 80s, it was a present. It was a Christmas present for my brother. But I was like, hey, this is cool. I want to play too, right? I was sort of like you in that respect. Like, I don't care. It's not for boys or girls or whatever. This is just a cool thing to play with. But I totally see what you're saying there, and that sort of led to this, okay, it's mostly boys, mostly men, boys who grew up during that time and who are now men, who are sort of dominating tech. But now we're seeing that backlash, right? Where it's like, okay, the women are realizing we get to play too. We need to play a role too, and we need to be less unsure of ourselves.
Well, and I think that especially in Silicon Valley, where the culture is so insular, if you're not, and I hope I don't offend anybody here, but what the heck, I've written about this on my blog. Silicon Valley, which is different from the Boston area where we are, but Silicon Valley has this horrible romance culture where if you're not a pretty reasonably affluent white middle class upbringing guy, kind of guy, people think that meeting for a beer at a bar is an interview. No, it's not an interview. It's meeting for a beer at a bar. So they're using criteria that have nothing to do with anybody's capabilities at work to judge a potential candidate's capabilities. It makes me nuts. So I think that people are now realizing that that's not an interview. It's not a way to assess anyone's capabilities. But this is built into the culture right now, and it's really a problem.
I agree with the bro culture, bromance culture. There's a show on HBO, Silicon Valley, and I've had a number of friends say I can't watch that show because it's too much like reality. That it's almost like watching a documentary, that it's funny because it's true almost. But I do know folks who are in the Silicon Valley area, San Francisco area, who women who love their jobs, and it's not like that at all. But it's one of the reasons why I joke from time to time that Boston beats Silicon Valley because we have a much better culture around that. At least that's been my experience
Well,
anyway.
and there are exceptions to every generality,
Sure.
right? So, I think that there are exceptions to every for anybody, any given environment. It is what you make of it. And if you are willing to try and get into a particular environment, you can actually change the culture if you want.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very empowering message. I love that. I love it. So let's talk a little bit more, Johanna, about your transition and the actual do consulting, the consulting work that you've been doing. You've been doing it for quite some time now. According to LinkedIn, it's 22 years and 11 months. So you're coming up on your 22 year your in or 23, sorry, year anniversary of starting your consulting firm. Is that right?
That's correct,
That's
yes.
awesome. And so, in thinking about what to ask you, here, what I came up with was essentially if you were to look at the kinds of things that you help your the client, kinds of problems that you help your clients solve. But what are the one or two areas where clients need the most help with, but don't really realize that that's what they need the most help with? And just to put a little context in it, for folks who may not be consultants or familiar with this, what happens very often when you're a consultant or a coach like we are is people come to you with problem X. You dig deeper, you to find the real problem. When you find out that really the problem is Y and Z, it's really something else. So what I'm curious of from you is what are the Y's and Z's? What are the things that people really need help with that they didn't think that they did?
So I was, I've seen this from the beginning of my career. The managers think that the teams are too slow, right? The rate of throughput, and this does not matter if the team is doing agile or anything else, but the rate of finishing stuff is too slow, and the manager is so frustrated. The team needs to learn how to estimate, or the team needs to learn different approaches to projects. Or the team needs a good kick in the pants, or the team needs something. And almost inevitably, when I hear a manager say the team needs something, 99% of the time it's because the managers are not managing the project portfolio. So the team members are multitasking on several projects. The worst thing I saw was one guy who was supposed to spend 50% of his time on 17 different projects. That was nuts. I mean, I don't even know where anybody got 50%, and the 17 projects was just crazy. So I often see that when things are too slow, it's a consequence of upstream kinds of problems. And then if people ask me about managing the project portfolio, I often find that the managers are trying. They're trying like crazy to manage the project portfolio, but senior management won't decide on one strategy. They change the strategy every other week, and the organization is not set up for them to change the strategy every other week. So I see a lot of we identify the problem in one place, but it's almost always, and you will like this, a people problem farther upstream. There are several other examples. Would you like some more?
Yeah, sure. Another example would be great.
So one of the things I did an assessment back in the early 2000s at some point, 2003 or four, and the senior manager said to me, I have 2,000 or 3,000 world-class developers. He said, they make every single deadline. And I said, really? Because I know from de about developers, and my experience is, they make about half their estimates, and they are not going to make the other half. He said, my developers make every single deadline. The testers, on the other hand, never make any deadline at all. It doesn't matter how much time I give them. They can never finish a project in time. So I thought, there's something funny going on here. And when I did the assessment, sure enough, the developers were incented and measured on making their deadlines. And that's all they were incented on. So they would check in stubs into the configuration management system, right? They would have the start of the function and the end, and nothing in the middle. And then the testers, by testing, would actually uncover all this stuff. So it looked like the developers were great, and the testers were idiots. But in reality, it was the other way around. So, well, and it's not really the other way around. The entire system was broken for everybody. So when I said that to the senior manager, he got very angry at me. He said, our system is not broken. I set up this system. And I thought, oh, that's, I should have asked who set up the system. And he said he was so angry he could barely see straight. And when I realized that, I thought, okay, He's not going to listen to me. But I learned that several years later, they actually he got promoted to a different area in the company, and they actually started to use an agile approach, which is a collaborative team-based approach as opposed to flowing work from person to person. So that I'm not sure if my assessment made that happen or what, but certainly they started to make changes much earlier on.
Got it. And you mentioned Agile. I definitely want to geek out about Agile just a little bit in a moment. But one other question that I have for you, Johanna, just around the kinds of problems that you help people solve. And you're absolutely right that they're people. A lot of them are people problems, and that's sort of my area of expertise. So how would you categorize what kinds of people problems?
So I think that there's the big system problems where senior managers think that the system works one way, but the system works in entirely a different way. So back when I was inside the organization, I used to come home and complain to my poor long-suffering husband that senior management had no idea what we did. They had, once they got past their level of senior management, they had no idea what middle management or first line management or any of the technical staff did. So that's where it's a problem of not seeing the entire system, where the environment creates a system where some of the work is invisible to some people, right? The work from middle management on down is invisible to senior management, and the work of senior management is invisible to the middle management and on down. So there's this big kind of dash line, and the people don't get to see what's going on. That's partially a system problem and partially a people problem, but it's at least 98% a system problem. And it gets that way because it does, but one of the reasons it gets that way is because the senior managers focus on single dimension measurements. So if you only look at date, like that poor guy who wanted me to do the assessment, you're only going to get stuff about the date. You're not going to get anything about what's in the release or how good it is. You're not going to get anything about the run rate of the team or any of the other costs of doing business. So I see this especially in distributed teams. People have no idea, right? Senior management has no idea of the cost of doing business in a distributed team. But there is a way to measure this now called cost of delay. So we can actually say the fact that we have wait states, this costs us X amount of money per day. And every time we have to ask a question from here and you can't get an answer until there, that's a cost of delay of 2 days. And we can put an average run rate on that, and that's what it costs you to have this distributed team who is trying to work collaboratively. So there are ways we can manage the system if we are willing to go past a single dimension measurement.
Absolutely. I am a me I geek out about many things. One of the things that I geek out though about the most is measurement. How do we measure? How do we, for example, put dollar signs or put real quantitative measures around the people problems to get people to see that these are real problems. These are not just in our head. These aren't just some touchy-feely woo-woo, we need to be nice to one another kinds of problems. That there are actual dollar sign numerical consequences to these kinds of things. So I'm so glad you brought that up. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant handholding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So let's talk about Agile. Sound good?
Absolutely.
Cool. So what I thought, how I thought that we could start this is I brought up the Agile manifesto. It's very brief. And so I thought I would read that just to start, just to sort of put this all in context for myself. And I admit that I am an Agile newbie. I'm pretty unknowledgeable when it comes to the intricacies of Agile, but I help people who work for Agile or Agile-ish kinds of organizations. So I've heard it enough to know that it's a big deal and worth talking about. But just to sort of set the frame, I'm going to read the very brief Agile manifesto for Agile software development, and folks can find this at agilealliance.org. And it basically just says this: we are uncovering better ways of developing software by doing it and helping others do it. Through this work, we have come to value individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, responding to change over following a plan. That is, while there is value in the items on the right, we value the items on the left more. So that's the Agile manifesto, as to sort of set the stage here. So Johanna, I'd love to hear about your experience with Agile, and also your thoughts about the future of the Agile methodology.
So for those of you who listened to Jen read that, behind that page is the values of the manifesto. And that's what they talk about: customer collaboration and the best measure of working, the best measure is working software, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I am a big fan of the values of Agile. And for me, they incorporate the lean values also, which is respect for the people and seeing the whole, making decisions at the last responsible moment as opposed to the last possible moment, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I got started with Agile, although I did not realize this, back in the 80s. I was managing a project, and I said, you know, I need to be able to deliver incremental value and get feedback from my customer. So I did. We implemented by feature. Now, feature-driven development is not literally an Agile approach, because we iterated over the features, but we put together a large chunk of features to deliver and then got feedback from the customer. So we did not have a regular cadence. We were not smart enough to do retrospectives at the time. We did little 15-minute things that said, huh, that worked, that's good. What do we do now? So at the time, I was using rolling wave planning, which mm-hmm. is plan a little bit now. And as you are willing to plan a little bit more, so that you always have anywhere from a 2 to 4 week rolling wave. And back in the 80s and 90s, I did a 4 week rolling wave. I now do a 1 or 2 week rolling wave, just because things change a lot more often. Mm-hmm. So I've been using Agile approaches for a very long time. But back in 2003 or 4, I did an assessment for an organization, and they were using 6 week iterations. Mm-hmm. They were having trouble finishing their work in the 6 week iteration. And I said, that's because there's too much work. So reduce the iteration down to 4 weeks or 3 weeks. And they said, the program manager actually said to me, I'm not sure that that's right. I think that if we extend the iteration, we'll get more in. I said, no, that's not how things work. The longer you have between releasing anything, the more pressure there is for requirements coming in mm-hmm. to the group or into the project or into the program. So the way to reduce the requirements pressure is you reduce the shipping duration. So if you're at 6 weeks now, go down to 3 weeks mm-hmm. or 2 weeks, right? Whatever it is. Now, I was not suggesting that they go Agile. They had a project with hardware. They had recalcitrant customers. They had all kinds of things that were not going to allow collaboration between them and their customer, but they would have collaboration inside the organization. And when they started to do that, all of a sudden things got a lot better. And I thought, oh, I just turned into an agilist. So I had been doing what's called stage delivery, which is an incremental life cycle. I was using it with 4-week time boxes because I knew better than to try and do anything longer than a month. And, you know, I had been doing stuff that kind of sort of looked like agile, but it wasn't until about 2004 that I said, okay, this is really where I need to go with my career, and this is what my customers will get a lot of benefit out of.
Got it. And you mentioned values. I'm so glad you brought up values because one of the things that I hear my tech manager friends and my clients talking about sometimes is, well, number one is, yeah, I work for an agile company. We're kind of sort of an agile company where we're sort of, you know, it's in dips and drabs, whereas we're kind of dabbling. But sometimes I have friends say, yeah, we're, you know, it's completely totally agile. But to the dabbling, to the dabblers, it seems like what folks are saying or seeing is that we're sort of missing the point that if you're just dabbling and especially if you're missing the core values, and that if you're so just doing it because we need some process, right? And you just get you get in it just for the process sake and miss the core values, that you're missing the whole point of it. Like the first value statement in the Agile Manifesto is individuals and interactions over processes and tools. So my guess is that you've might have some experience and thoughts around this, that sort of people missing the point of Agile and just kind of diving into it without really knowing, without really embracing the core values.
Yes. So there are a lot of people who, well, let me tell you a story of one of my clients. I came in and did, they said, we're having trouble going to use using Scrum. It's just not working for us. And we want all the teams to use Scrum. And I said, why? They said, because we'll get something every 2 weeks. I said, okay, but that's a cadence of delivery. Are you sure you need people to use Scrum with all the ceremonies and rituals and necessary roles? Or do you just want to set up a cadence of delivery every 2 weeks? They said, huh? So now, Scrum is a perfectly good project management framework, right? It's a great framework as long as you have a full-time collaborative cross-functional team that never gets pulled off to work on anything else. As long as you have a scrum master and probably a coach, and you need a full-time customer or product owner. So without all of, and it's really hard, really, really hard to make scrum work if you have a distributed team. Can you? Of course, you can do anything, but it's so hard. Why would you do that to yourself? So I said to them, you don't actually need to use Scrum if you want a delivery of every 2 weeks. You just say to people, we want you to deliver whatever is done every 2 weeks. And if nothing is done, that's not a team problem. That's a product owner and team problem. Or it's a product roadmap and a product owner and a team problem. It's not just the team, right? This is not a function of the team being idiots. The team is not idiots. They're working in the system, and the system is not working for them. So when I said that, I mean, I was a little nicer. I was not quite so ranty. But when I said that to them, they said, well, maybe we could just ask the team to deliver something every week, whatever they're done. They finish, they were all set to ask for delivery at Friday at noontime. And I said, how about Wednesday at noontime? Right? Wednesday at noontime means people are probably not on vacation. They know in the summer, they don't want to leave early. So just do Wednesday at noontime. Whatever they're done with Wednesday at, you know, 10 a.m., they package it up. They're ready to deliver by noontime. They deliver it. It's not such a big deal. Everything will work. And then it doesn't even matter what system that the team, any of the teams use. to finish their work, as long as they know they have a cadence of delivery every Wednesday. Now, if they miss a Wednesday, especially if it's every week, what is the consequence of that? Right? Is that something that they can learn from? Or are you going to come down on these people like a ton of bricks? They said, let me guess, we should not come down on them like a ton of bricks. I said, no, you should not. So this is actually why I actually finished, well, my Create Your Successful Agile Project book is in beta right now, but my part's done, right? It's ready for copy editing and layout and indexing. But that's why I wrote this book. So many people think that there's only one way to do Agile. Yeah. No.
Right.
No, there's any number of ways.
Right. Right. And this may be getting a little bit too into the weeds, but this is something that I've been wondering. Because you mentioned Scrum. And from the way that I hear people talk about it, they seem to use, sometimes anyway, from my perception, they seem to use Agile and Scrum interchangeably versus other people. It's like, no, this is different. So can you explain it in your words, from your perspective, what's the difference between Agile and Scrum?
So Agile is an umbrella that actually includes Lean, feature-driven development, XP, as in extreme programming, Kanban, Scrum, disciplined Agile, if you really want to use that. I don't recommend any of the frameworks, but any of the frameworks. Agile is all of those things.
Yeah.
Scrum is one approach. Now, it's a very famous approach, and the Scrum people were so smart to have the very first certification that really made it something that people wanted to get. Good for them. The marketing is terrific, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
It's just not for everybody. So when people say Agile / Scrum, I just want to shake them and say, no, Agile is the big umbrella. Scrum is one small approach. And one of the real problems with Scrum is that there is no technical practices associated with it. You have to figure out what technical practices you need to use in your team. And everybody's team is going to be different, right? I might think that there's no project that cannot use continuous integration, but I don't know about your team and your project. Maybe you cannot. So, if you don't ever think about any of the technical practices, then you will not actually get working software, never mind any kind of a working product, at the end of any iteration.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think about technical practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's loud and clear. Agile is the umbrella. Scrum is one of the raindrops that might fall under the umbrella, but there are many others as well.
Yes.
And I love what you said earlier, that there's no just one way to do Agile. It's making it work and molding it to work with your team and your environment.
Absolutely.
Cool. I'd love, Johanna, to hear about your thoughts about the future of Agile. So given all that we've talked about, the different approaches, the way that people are approaching it, if you look into your crystal ball, what do you see for the future of Agile?
So I'm really hoping that people start to use the principles and the values more than they use a framework. I am seeing, people only call a consultant when they have trouble, right? So I'm seeing clients where they say, we tried Scrum and it didn't work, or we tried Kanban and it didn't work, and we tried XP and it didn't work. And that's when I have to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Because something should work. I totally understand if Scrum doesn't work, but how can XP practices and Kanban not work? So I often discover that there's some kind of a piece of culture missing in the organization. And my hope, I'm not very good at crystal balls, but my hope is that people will realize that culture is the most important thing when you start to talk about any kind of project approach. If you want to be agile, you have to have a cultural component to it. It's a cultural change, not just a different project management framework.
Mm-hmm.
So in the future, I'm hoping that people will realize that while certifications might be helpful for people to actually learn how to understand what Agile is. Certifications are not the end all and be all. And just because you have a certification does not mean you actually know anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that people go back to the principles, go back to the values and say, how do we do this kind of thing here? Mm-hmm. How do we make it work for us? What do we need to do for our culture, our people, our systems of work, our products, our customers, right? What is our entire system of work? And then we can figure out how to make Agile work here.
That is an excellent message to end on for now. We'll say to be continued as far as the Agile stuff, but that's an excellent message to end on with that. So let's move to the final question. This is a question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and you can interpret it any way that you wish. It's really just a question designed to get the wheels turning a little bit. And so the question is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
So I've been thinking about this one because I listened to your other podcasts and I knew that you asked that question. And I am pretty sure that the answer I want to talk about is about culture. Mm. Ed Schein defined culture as what people can talk about, what they can discuss, how people treat each other, and, oh, of course, what's the third thing? Oh. What's rewarded?
Okay.
So, and I find that when I start to think about what does this organization reward, that drives certain behaviors. What are people allowed to talk about? That drives other behaviors. How do people treat each other? That drives yet other behaviors. And when you think about the different kinds of cultures, and there is no bad culture, there's no great culture, there's just the culture that you have. And I see system problems manifesting themselves in the culture. So when I think about the biggest people-related challenge, it's helping people to see what culture they have versus the culture that they want. Mm-hmm. And when they think about the differences in culture, what do they have to reward differently? What do they have to have people discuss differently? What can people talk about? Right? How do people treat each other? When we start asking these kinds of questions, we start to say, oh, we can change that particular people problem or even a project or a program problem. Mm-hmm. Because if we start rewarding differently, we will get different results. So that's the biggest thing for me. It's all about the culture of the organization.
Yep. And I love that because it seems like a lot of times, and I'm guilty of this too, that we want to put band-aids on problems. So we want a quick fix. Like, oh, okay, I can help you. But that often those quick fix band-aid kind of solutions don't get to the real root of the problem. And the real root of a lot of organizational problems are around culture, are around and shifting that culture. And you can't do that overnight. It's going to take time. It's going to be hard. But that's the level of thinking that we need to be doing, whether it's talking about getting Agile to work for you or whether it's talking about solving people problems or any of the number of organizational challenges that people face. That culture is a big deal. It's almost like an overused word. They're like, oh yeah, I know culture is important. Yeah, I've heard it a ton of times. But I think that it can't be underlined enough because that is the root of a lot of what happens in an organization, good, bad, or otherwise.
Yep.
Awesome. So it's been great talking with you, Johanna. I loved geeking out about all of this stuff about Agile and hearing your career path and talking a little bit about your management consulting stuff. And so just to end on, let people how can people find you? And you mentioned you have a book coming up. How can they look you up and find that stuff?
So I'm at jrothman.com, JROTHMAN.com. I'm Johanna Rothman on Twitter. I'm, I think, Johanna Rothman on LinkedIn. I mean, it's all me. and my upcoming newest book is Create Your Successful Agile Project, Collaborate, Measure, Estimate, Deliver. And I invite people to email me or stop by my site and contact me. I would love to be able to continue the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would underline that too. Definitely check out Johanna's stuff and her upcoming book and everything else. It's been wonderful talking to you, Johanna. And I see that you're really adding a lot of value to this space and value that that is really needed. So it's been excellent talking with you. And I hope to catch up again in the future.
I hope so too. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you. All right.